Okay, we'll start. So we'll go. Okay. Yeah. I'll permess li kon għawda xienta. Yeah, okay. Let's start with okay. Right. Thank you very much. First of all, before we start the meeting, I would like that the members of the committee will approve the minutes of the last session. So I can sign them. Okay. Thank you very much. I would like to inform the members present. Yes, you can take them. That today's meeting is not being broadcast directly on our channel, Parliamentary Channel TV, or streamed on Parliamentary website, since it falls within the period of silence ahead of the vote of the European Parliament elections tomorrow, and also the local council elections. However, it will be on demand after the period of silence. I would like, I would further like to inform our guests today, Honourable Green, the Chair of the Committee for Public Standards in the UK, and also Mrs. Stones, the Chair, the Commissioner for Public Standards in the UK, that this meeting is open to the public, and as I said, will be recorded for the eventual demand of whoever wants to follow the proceedings. I trust that there are no objections to these arrangements. So I'd like to start by welcoming the UK Commissioner for Standards, Kathleen Stone, and you, the chairperson of the Committee of Standards or Committee on Standards of the UK House of Commons, Mrs. Kate Green. And I'm asking you to join in the table. I would like also to thank Dr. George Hisler, and his office for making this meeting possible. Thank you, George. Allow me, first of all, to introduce the members present of the meeting. I have on my right Honourable Byron Camilleri, who is the whip of the government and also a member of the committee, and Honourable Edward Zammit-Lewis, who is also a member of the committee. On my left, I have Honourable Simon Wuzuti, who is a former leader of the opposition, and he is also the member of this committee. Honourable Kamino Swanishi, previous minister and a member of the opposition, and also present, we have Honourable Carol Aquilina, he's a member of the opposition. As you are well aware, the Malta, the Act on Public Standards in Public Life has been in force for a few months, and it was just recently, a couple of months ago, on the 30th of October, 2018, that Dr. George Hisler was appointed as our Commissioner for Public Standards. So it is should thus come as no surprise that to a certain extent the Commissioner and our committee are still on a learning, let's put it that way, learning curve. We are very interested to exchange and to learn more about the work that you, as Chair and the Commissioner, and your respective offices carry out, and your perspectives on the issues involved. As you probably also know, that our standing orders, oh, I have to tell you, if you don't know, refer us to the practice and procedures of the House of Commons. There's a particular standing order, which is very often quoted, where in the absence of a proper standing order that address the procedure, then, of course, I have to refer Speaker of the House to the procedure that is adopted in the House of Commons when our own rules somehow are insufficient. So this makes our interest in your experience even greater, I would say. So I now invite you, Chair, of the Committee of UK to address the members, after which I will also ask the members if they have any query or questions to your presentation. You put on. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mr. Speaker, and it is a real pleasure and an honour to be here today to meet my counterparts on the Committee of Standards here in the Maltese Parliament, and I want to thank you for our invitation. We're very happy to be able to exchange ideas. And I should say already in meetings yesterday with the Commissioner and his colleagues, Catherine and I have already been picking up some new ideas for areas that we wish to take back to our Parliament and explore. The committee which I chair is responsible to the House of Commons, the whole of the House of Commons, to advise on standards and conduct matters among Members of Parliament. And we are a committee of both parliamentarians, but also in equal numbers, so seven parliamentarians, we also have seven unelected lay members who are appointed through our regular public appointments process. And I believe that the committee now is occupying a much more high-profile and strategically significant role than it has had to do for quite a number of years. That's partly because of a general collapse in trust in politics and politicians in our country, and I see that collapse in trust replicated in other countries and other democracies. Politics is in a difficult place, and I think as a robust, rigorous and trusted standard system is an important brick in the wall that we need to rebuild to ensure the public that they have political systems and institutions which function with integrity. It's also under pressure in the UK Parliament, and we are in the public eye now because of a particular scandal last year in relation to bullying and sexual harassment, where allegations have been made both against members of Parliament and, in fact, also against members of staff, which has been, I guess, again, part of a wider international context, the hashtag MeToo scandals that are playing out in different industries and democracies around the world. But both of those anxieties are really serving to put the Committee on Standards very much in the public eye and in the parliamentary eye again right now. And this is actually true of the history of the committee over the last 20 or 25 years. Every time there's a scandal, something happens to the standard system and to the committee to address that particular scandal. So in the 1990s, we had the Cash for Questions scandal, where members were taking, effectively, payments for instruction to ask a particular question or advance a particular case in the House. Then approximately 10 years ago, and that led to the creation of the standard system and the committee and the beginnings of an objective code that we could look to determine how MPs should behave. In the late 1990s and into the early 2000s, we had the expenses scandal, which was about MPs claiming public support for what were really personal expenses. Some of them were really notorious, the duck houses, the flipping of houses. So in one year you'd claim for one house and then you'd flip round and claim for your other house the following year to maximise your income. The response to that was to set up an independent parliamentary standards authority, which is wholly responsible now for the payment of both MPs' salaries and MPs' expenses, and to introduce a pay-setting process in which MPs play no part. So despite the fact that the public remain convinced that we debate and vote on our own pay, in fact we don't. That is completely outsourced to an independent external body to determine MPs' pay. And then the most recent scandal, as I say, is the sexual harassment and bullying allegations, which the committee is dealing with in the context of a broader piece of work that the House of Commons undertook under the leadership of the then Leader of the Commons, Mrs. Andrea Leadsom, which has resulted in our new independent complaints and grievance system and new investigatory capacity, which I think Catherine will say a little bit about in a moment. And my committee in particular has been working most recently on how we play our part in that process, which will be at the point where either a case was referred to us to consider and make a recommendation to the House of a penalty, or if somebody wished to appeal a finding that the Commissioner has made, either on the grounds that evidence has come to light which the Commissioner had not considered, or if they think that the proposed sanction is unfair and inappropriate. So we're a very busy committee at the moment and very high profile. And as part of the way in which we've tried to offer reassurance to both other parliamentarians and the wider public. We've also been taking some steps recently to strengthen the independence, the impartiality of the committee. In particular, at the beginning of this year, agreeing a change to our standing orders, which now mean that our external lay members enjoy full voting rights, something they did not have before in the committee when we were taking decisions. And in fact, the consequence of the way the committee is established is that they have a de facto voting majority now, because as chair I have only a casting vote. So should the seven external members choose to vote as a block, they would outnumber the parliamentary members' votes, and I hope we'll never have to test that. Votes are extremely rare in the committee, but we did have one in the last few months, and that's really been an important, I think, powerful change, which we point to demonstrate our determination to have as objective and impartial and trusted system as we possibly can. We're still in a state of change and development. We've had further reports since the independent complaints system was brought in, one from a High Court judge, suggesting MPs should play no part at all in the determination of complaints against MPs. We are not sure where that will end up. We are awaiting two more reports in the House of Commons and one more in the House of Lords relating to a review of the new system, relating to the way in which members of Parliament and our contractual relationships with our own staff should be managed within the context of the standard system. And the House of Lords, which is going through similar pressures for change and has made a number of important changes to the way its committee operates, is also undergoing an independent external review of its procedures. So we're very much in the public eye, I think, just now, and probably coping with quite a lot of scepticism about our ability to self-regulate. So it will be interesting to hear if that's an experience that you are having too. But I think perhaps now that Catherine's been able to join us, it might be useful if you wanted to talk a little about the nuts and bolts of what we do.
So before I take any questions, I now invite Mrs. Kathleen Stone, which is the UK Commissioner of Standards, to address the members of the committee. Okay. You've got the floor.
Thank you very much, and once again, thank you for your invitation to join you today. Like Kate, this is my first visit to Malta, and it's incredibly impressive, the warmth of your welcome and the generosity of your hospitality and kindness, so thank you very much for that. As Kate has said, we work very closely together as Commissioner and Committee, and Kate isn't aware that I'm going to say this, but we are very fortunate to have Kate as our Chair. On the basis of her knowledge, skill and experience and determination to facilitate debate and bring that to an action point that will deliver change. And Kate is very modest in underplaying her impact on the committee and the changes that she's just set out, so I'd like to do that for her. In addition to the changes to the voting rights for lay members, we've also introduced some changes to the way that my office works. And you might not consider these to be very radical, but in fact they are. Until January of this year, you had to write to me formally in hard copy. So you had to fish out your notepaper envelopes and stamps to make a complaint to me. But since January, a decision has been taken that people can email complaints to me, which might not sound radical, but it actually is. A number of other very important changes which promote my independence. When I arrived, if I wanted to refer a matter to the police, if I had a suspicion of evidence of criminality, I had to first seek permission from the committee. And this struck me as a very unusual thing to do. And the committee supported that being changed. So now I can go direct to the police if I suspect evidence of criminality. And I can also, if I feel that there is sufficient evidence, begin an investigation into a code of conduct matter that goes back more than 7 years without seeking permission first from the committee, which again was something that I would have had to do at the outset of my tenure. Kate's spoken about the introduction of the Behaviour Code, the Independent Complaints and Grievance Scheme. I'm responsible for oversight of investigations under that scheme into members of Parliament where they've been accused of bullying, harassment and sexual harassment. That is a very real culture shift in our House of Commons. The scheme applies also to the House of Lords, and interestingly, the House of Lords are interpreting that and the implementation of that in a slightly different way from the way that we are. The review of that behaviour code is about to conclude, the six-month review is about to conclude, and I'm sure it will highlight many limitations. But importantly, the positive development is a culture shift in the House of Commons that bullying, harassment and sexual misconduct will not be tolerated, and there is now a mechanism for people to bring forward their complaints, and when it comes to members of Parliament, I will oversee those investigations. So, as Kate has outlined for the committee, it's very busy, it's very much in the public eye. In addition to the other code of conduct, we're having to expand our office, increase our staff, take on our own lawyer to provide us with advice and guidance, because we were taking up a lot of time of the parliamentary lawyers. So they tactfully, or perhaps not so tactfully, suggested that we get our own lawyer. So we've done that. But we have a huge amount of knowledge, skill and experience within our team, and we very, very much look forward to developing the codes of conduct and reviewing the rules alongside the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Cathy Stone. I was surprised with the comment you said that you cannot go straight away to the Commissioner of Police if there is a case against, if from the investigation you carry out, you can now, but it was not before.
It's a recent development. Yeah. Since January of this year, I can go direct to the police, but previously my predecessors would have had to seek permission from the committee. Yeah. And again, it's just an important symbolic milestone in the promotion of the independence of the Office of the Commissioner from the committee.
Yeah. And we got to House of Lords before I open the floor to the other members. I mean, they are still not under your scrutiny?
The House of Lords has its own commissioner.
They appointed their own commissioner?
They have their own commissioner. And although the behaviour...
Originally, it was not the case, is it? Originally, because when during the John Major government, when your office came into the offing, I mean, the House of Lords were outside that scrutiny?
They I'm not quite sure when. I think they've always been outside of that scrutiny, and they have their own commissioners. The House of Lords, interestingly, has in its code a comment, a line about Lords, members of the House of Lords must always act on their honour.
Okay.
And that's always been open to interpretation about what is an honourable thing for a member of the House of Lords to do. And I'm grateful I don't have to consider
so,
that.
So I open the floor. Any questions or comments? Honourable Azim Muhammad Lewis.
For this overview.
Microphone.
Before this overview, because while you were speaking, obviously we were drawing comparisons with our NU law. One question which I have is whether you mentioned the complaint procedure, which is now can be even lodged electronically. One question is whether you can take action on your own initiative. That is, whether something in the public domain you can just. Okay. Thank you very much.
I can do that, and I have done that on a number of occasions where, for example, following a television documentary or a media story which has made allegations that are so serious, it requires an immediate commentary about an investigation, and I have done that.
Simon Bozzotti.
Thank you, Chair. Well, let me first start by joining the chairperson of this committee in welcoming you both here and in thanking you for being with us and for sharing your knowledge and experience with us. As the Speaker said, we are a new committee and we are operating under a new law, and he rightly pointed out that we're still in the learning curve, and the learning curve is very much vertical at this stage. I have three questions to put to you, if I may. The first two relate to your own work, and the third one relates to our local situation. Well, the first question relates to the numbers that have been handed over to us of the complaints you have handled since April last year. I am noting in this graph, in this chart, that puts the numbers of the number of complaints received and handled by your office since April 2018 until end February this year. And I see that you've received a total of more than 2,000 complaints, but you have just started 15 inquiries. And I find that put it charitably, a very small number of complaints that you have started. And I'm wondering what the reason behind that is. Obviously, I note that last July you received more than 1,200 complaints in one specific month, and you only accepted to open one. So I was wondering what was the reason for that. The second question relates to lay members. I'm extremely intrigued by your reference to lay members. May I ask you to perhaps explain to us how the system works, who exactly are the lay members, how they are appointed, because this is something that I find to be a very interesting development that we might perhaps discuss even at our level. And finally, my third question. You have mentioned that you went into a complaint that went back 7 years.
I'm now able to do that. I haven't actually done that.
Okay.
I now have the authority to do that should I wish to.
I see.
But
okay.
We haven't
okay.
actually started.
Okay. Well, one of the issues we are facing relates to complaints about alleged misconduct that happened before our law entered into force last year. So far, the line that has been taken locally has been, we will only deal with complaints about alleged misconduct with effect from the date of the entry into force of the law. And that leaves me with the question, what do we do about the scandals that happened before? And as you rightly pointed out, it often takes a scandal to develop a law and to improve standards, and that, I think, is exactly our own experience. But we're still left with this question, what do we do about issues that took place before the law entered into force? And maybe you can help us explore that issue. Thank you.
You can.
Yeah. Well, I'm very, very happy to answer those questions. And if we turn first to the numbers, it's very interesting. Our office, the Office of the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards, in recent times, particularly around the Brexit debates, has been the focus of people's ire, their concern about the conduct of members of Parliament. And we have many, many, many complaints from members of the public who feel that their Member of Parliament is not carrying out their specific individual wishes. So a member of the public will complain to my office that they voted to remain and their Member of Parliament is voting to leave the European Union. And so they complain that their Member of Parliament is breaching the code of conduct because they're not following the wishes of the individual member of the public. Now, that is not a matter for my office. And we are polite and courteous in our responses and explain that members of parliament are elected to express their views and opinions. And, of course, it's for constituents to disagree with them. But the way that they can disagree with their member of parliament is either in a surgery meeting or ultimately at the ballot box. In July, we had a spike of complaints following the decision by the Electoral Commission to fine a young man £20,000 for a breach of electoral rules. Three members of Parliament tweeted in support of this young man, and over 1,000 people wrote to us to say that these three members of Parliament should not support this man because he'd broken the law. Now, again, members of Parliament historically and thankfully have supported people who have been victims of miscarriages of justice or have supported them, you know, following a decision that was taken by the courts. And again, we had to say to those individuals, these are the members of parliament, it's perfectly acceptable for them to support whomsoever they wish, and it might not be a decision that you agree with. The Electoral Commission took that decision. Those members of parliament disagree with that decision and they're expressing their views and opinions. Just in terms of the complaints that we do investigate, what we expect from people when they make an allegation is that they provide evidence that supports the allegation that they're making. So if somebody were to say, this Member of Parliament, I think, has brought the House into disrepute, which is a very high bar, they have to provide the evidence which supports that. And that brings me neatly on to the discussion about historical or non-recent allegations. Now, we have quite a confusing picture currently in that we have a code of conduct and we also have a behaviour code. In terms of the code of conduct investigations, I am, since January 2019, able, if I consider there is sufficient evidence to support the beginning of an investigation, able to go back more than 7 years to look into that allegation. If an allegation is made under the behaviour code, the bullying, harassment and sexual harassment code, which is a separate code, at the moment there is not the possibility, no mechanism to do that before the beginning of before July 2017. That is out to consultation. The House of Commons Commission, which is the body that sets the decision-making parameters, has gone out to consultation to say that we should be able to look into allegations of bullying, harassment and sexual harassment before July 2017 without limit of time based on the evidence that's available. So my view is that if the evidence is available and if the evidence is sufficiently cogent and strong, it might be that there is more evidence available to look into allegations of misconduct 5 years ago, 7 years ago, than there is 6 weeks ago. If somebody just makes an allegation that you did something, if they make an allegation that you did something and here's the evidence, here's the paperwork, here's the diary entries, here's the records of the phone calls that supports that, it might be that the investigation will be able to proceed and withstand scrutiny, because remember, my investigations quite properly are subject to scrutiny not only by the committee, but ultimately by the whole House. And when we are talking about members of parliament, very high profile individuals, as Kate has already said, there is a possibility that there can be a political motivation for people making such allegations, and we have to be very, very careful that those things stand to scrutiny. Kate, do you want to add to that?
Honourable Green.
So I will say two things. First of all, a little more about the discussion on non-recent cases, and then I'll address your question about lay members. On the non-recent cases, as Catherine says, there's currently a consultation underway to invite opinions on whether older allegations of sexual harassment and bullying can be investigated. And I think there will be quite a lot of public pressure and pressure from within Parliament, including from parliamentary staff, that it should be possible for those cases to be investigated. There have been a number already exposed in the media, and I think that there is an expectation among a number of stakeholders that these cases should be capable of investigation if they meet the criteria that Catherine has set out. We're in a different position from you, I guess, to some extent, in that none of our standard system is covered in legislation. It's all in standing orders of the House. So if you have, as you may, an issue with retrospective application of legislation, which we certainly would in all other contexts, that's something we don't have to trouble about in the case of our standard system, because it's not actually on our statute book, it's within our internal standing orders. And I can see that might be a real difference, actually, in terms of how what we are able to consider and what you are able to consider could really play out in quite a different way. But in the House of Lords, in fact, recently, we have had a case, a non-recent case, which was extremely controversial, which was the case of Lord Leicester, which was allegations of sexual misconduct going back about a decade, I think?
12 years.
12 years, and which became extremely high profile and has led, really, the House of Lords into a position where they've had to make some very far-reaching changes to their own standard system, because it was felt that the way in which that matter was handled and the way it became a subject of political debate on the floor of the House was extremely damaging to the person making the allegations. She chose in the end to out herself, to reveal who she was, but the problem was, until then, there was an opportunity for anyone in the House of Lords to say anything about her without her being able to go out publicly, really, and defend her own side of the case. So I think there's an interesting set of things going on there about public expectation, actually, and why non-recent cases might become something that the public really expects us to be able to deal with, particularly if they contain serious allegations, and particularly if they are where the evidence is very strong. There's always a question, I guess, about is it reasonable to judge people today by the standards of the past? These are judgments we will have to make if these cases come before Catherine or come before the committee. But I think myself that the non-recent cases are likely to fall within the ambit of the system once this consultation has concluded. One of the changes that the House of Lords made in response to their Leicester scandal was to bring in lay members to their committee. On our committee, we have an equal number of lay members and parliamentarians. That's relatively recent. We started out with a situation where the lay members were in a minority. Then we equalised the numbers, but they did not have a vote, and the parliamentarians did. And as I was saying, the equal voting, or in fact the stronger voting rights for lay members, are a very, very recent innovation, only since the beginning of this year. They were appointed through our public appointments process for a four-year term, a one-off four-year term. And so the advertisement is placed on the the parliamentary and government websites in the same way as we advertise the opportunity for individuals to apply for any public appointment. We recruit to those posts under what we call the Nolan Principles, the standards that we apply to all aspects of public life, and indeed in which we are doing some work in the committee at the moment to ensure they're reflected in our own parliamentary codes. And we will actually be undergoing a recruitment process towards the end of this year, early next year, for two of our lay members who have to stand down because their term is coming to an end. And it will be really interesting to see who the applicants are, what sort of backgrounds they present to us. And we will be looking for people who have evidence of the appropriate skills and experience to take on a role in a regulatory system. Very much, in my mind, the importance of external independence. We don't want them to be cosy insiders. We want them to be people who very much bring that outside view, because I think that's important for public confidence and important if we want to maintain a system of self-regulation inside Parliament, which I think a lot of parliamentarians still hope to do. And there's a parallel recruitment process now going on in the House of Lords for them to recruit their lay members. And one of the questions that just came up the other day was whether it would be possible for a member to be a member of both committees, both the House of Commons Committee and the House of Lords Committee, as a lay member. That would not be possible for a parliamentarian because we cannot be members of both houses simultaneously. But it seems that there's a debate to be had about whether there might be benefits or disadvantages if lay members were able to sit on both committees at once. Who are they? They are people currently with a mix of backgrounds in, for example, human resources management, or who have sat on or continue to sit on other regulatory bodies, for example, medical regulatory bodies or sporting regulatory bodies. We have tried to ensure a diversity of representation in terms of different parts of the country being represented, different ages, different ethnicities, and we have a balance of 4 women and 3 men among our lay members at the moment. So there are a number of things that we are looking at when we are recruiting those lay members, but I think they are a strength in our system, in fact, and one that I would be extremely reluctant to see us lose or weaken. I think we need to make sure that that remains a very robust way in which we can assure the public of the integrity of the Standards Committee and its work.
Yeah, just one point to what you have been saying. With regards to the impartiality of the committee, I mean, our experience is that we debated that very strongly, because before we had the bill, there was the committee did meet on various occasions, and we also presented reports on the composition of the committee. And finally, notwithstanding there was the majority between the government and the opposition is quite strong for the moment, we still decided that only 2 members from the government and 2 members from the will sit in the committee, so that no there is no majority. The reflected majority of the government is not reflected in this committee, and that's to make sure that the impartiality will be there. And the speaker, that is who will preside, as in your case, I am the one who presides the committee. If there is a vote and it's tied, then it's my responsibility to cast the. So that's one point. The other point, which was asked by Simon Busuttil about the cut date when the commissioner can investigate, that was also debated, and it was unanimously agreed, because it became a law, that there would be a cut date. However, if the case is a crime, there is no need that the commission will intervene. You can always pass the crime to the authorities concerned. With regards to ethical behavior, there's a cut date. So I pass the...
Perhaps if I just say something about the political makeup of the 7 elected members in our committee. So the chair of the committee, that position is reserved for the official opposition. So I am an opposition MP, and this is always going to be a committee that will be chaired by the official opposition. We then have, of the other 6, so of the 7 members, 3 will be from the governing party, 3 will be from the main opposition party, and 1 from the minority party, currently the Scottish National Party. So we try to reflect the political balance broadly that you try to reflect to, of it not being a committee that allows a government majority. And I have to say, my committee, I've been chair since last October, does not divide on party lines. It has worked extremely well to achieve either consensus, usually, or where we have had a division of opinion, that division has not been on party lines. People, I think, feel themselves to be in a quasi-judicial mode when they are working as committee members, and they put their party allegiances to one side, and that's been one of its strengths.
In fact, in your committee, you rarely take a vote. I pass on the camera to Bonici.
During your replies, you hinted at the question that most of your or your regulation or is part of the standing orders. If I'm not mistaken, in Scotland, it's statute and it's not standing orders. What do you perceive to be the advantages or the disadvantages of having your system in contrast to the statute system, or as we have it, the statute system? Does it lend more flexibility? Does it lend less flexibility? Or does it give greater strength to the Parliament? Or does it give lesser authority in your decisions?
What an interesting question, and actually one that hasn't really been much debated in recent times in our Parliament. It hasn't been... Yeah, well, I'm thinking about it as he asked it. I think clearly the advantage of a statutory system is very clearly it's stated, the language is there. Obviously, there may be the opportunity for judicial interpretation of the statute. And one of the things we are an extremely live debate is taking place in our Parliament at the moment about whether we want to let the judiciary into our standards issues or not. And traditionally, we have kept the legislature and the judiciary entirely separate, the separation of powers, the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. And I think there would be a very live debate, indeed there is, without a discussion going on at the moment about whether we should have statutory underpinning of our system, there is already a live debate going on about whether the judiciary should have a role in handling standards complaints so that MPs no longer self-regulate and it's an independent system. Parliamentarians are, I think, divided on this question. And I think a lot of external stakeholders would probably like an external system, but there is a strong move inside as well to say that self-regulation is what that we would like to protect, and a real anxiety that if you open up one part of our parliamentary processes to judicial decision, then you place other aspects of parliamentary work, nothing to do with standards, at the same, potentially going down the same route. And in fact, we are having that debate in another committee I chair, the Privileges Committee, about whether there should be access to the courts for our parliamentary committees if a witness to a committee refuses, for example, to answer questions or to attend at all. On the other hand, the standing orders, although you would have thought they were flexible and allow us to react more quickly, we don't have to wait for time to legislate, and despite the fact that we're not legislating on anything very much in our Parliament at the moment, it's getting a slot in the legislative programme is difficult, always, you know, you're bidding for parliamentary time and that sort. Even to get the standing orders changed requires us as a committee to seek from the Leader of the House time to put those changes to standing orders through. Now, I must say, Mrs. Letson was an extremely helpful leader. She gave us time very quickly to make the changes that we've made in recent months, but we are at the mercy of the Leader of the House to make that parliamentary time available. Having said that, if she is willing to do it, then we can make the changes very quickly and swiftly, a debate on the floor of the House and a vote, and we don't have to go through the entire legislative process of that we would have to take a bill through. So I think you ask a really, really interesting question. The jury is very much out on it in the UK at the moment, and I would not like to predict where we will finish up.
Thank you very much. I don't know if there are any comments. If not, I would ask our Commissioner of Standards, George, is that, to make his own comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I thank the members of the committee for affording this time to meet my guests. I feel very privileged to have the opportunity of taking advantage of the experience of the Honourable Kate Green and Commissioner Stone. And as you can imagine, when somebody is appointed to a post, that is a first, he welcomes the opportunity of benefiting from the experience of other persons in that position. And I visited, as you are well aware, I visited London in February, and we had our first meetings there. And now we've had these meetings in Malta, and the staff at my office all met the Honourable Kate Green and Ms. Stone and are benefiting from this experience. There are, of course, significant differences between their position and our position. First of all, one, apart from the issue of whether it's part of standing orders or whether it's a specific statute, there is a difference that in our case we also deal with complaints against ministers. In their case, ministers do not fall within their remit. And we also have jurisdiction over persons of trust. That obviously doesn't apply to our counterparts. And these are obviously important developments. Our law is an important development on this. We are seeking their advice on some important reports that we will eventually be drawing up that are specified in the law. So we talk about how one deals with declarations of assets. I've had the opportunity to start examining declarations of assets that are submitted, and I've got a lot of questions to ask in this regard, mainly about ambiguity in the way they are interpreted. We'll be drawing up reports on or issuing guidelines on lobbying and gifts, on misuse of public resources, misuse of information, and also on the revolving doors policy. So all these are something that we will be discussing as we go along. And I was hoping to take the opportunity, in fact, we've discussed it in a preliminary manner, of extending a network of similar commissioners. To date, it doesn't exist. So whereas, Mr. Speaker, you could share experiences with other speakers in other jurisdictions and you would attend conferences and discuss informally and with other speakers, I would not have that opportunity. And I've proposed this to Ms. Stone, who thinks it's a good idea. Yeah. Now, whether one does it possibly through a Commonwealth organization, since we're not too sure whether the United Kingdom will or will not be part of the European Union in the next few months, or whether we go down the route of the European Union is another matter. But still, I think it would be a good idea to do that. Otherwise, just for the information of the committee, the website of my office has gone live at this moment, I mean just 10 minutes ago. So yes, this would be... yes, so obviously we'll see how to build that in the hope that the public will have better access to what we're doing.
An electronic
complaint
system?
Pardon? Not yet, no, but it will be coming on as well. However, and also, we did not have to face the issue of whether complaints can be accepted by email or otherwise. In our case, we accepted complaints by email. The only restriction we made was that we need to know who the complainant is, because otherwise we would treat it as an anonymous complaint. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying that an anonymous complaint will not be noted, because if the anonymous complaint is about a matter that can be established, can be investigated independently of the complainant's testimony, because obviously if it's anonymous, you would not want to come forward, and it's serious enough, I would take it on as a own initiative investigation. As regards another difference, you mentioned the Nolan principles. I haven't quite understood why. The Nolan principles are not part of the Code of Ethics of the members of Parliament. They are part of the Code of Ethics of Ministers, so they're in the Ministerial Code of Ethics, but not in our, and one of the suggestions when we come to propose changes to our Code of Ethics will be the incorporation of the Nolan principles in the Code of Ethics of Members of Parliament. I also noted your comment on the division or non-division on party lines in the committee, which is very much appreciated. I have no doubt that when this committee will be reviewing my reports, my case reports, I'm sure that this will be the case here as well. Otherwise, if it's not done in that manner, it will undermine the value of this committee. At the end of the day, our mission is to promote higher standards, not to keep the standards we have. In fact, I've noted that many of the persons I have called in an investigation seem to say, but that's how things happened in the past. Yes, but that's not what I'm here for. If the object of the exercise is to repeat past mistakes, then I don't think we'll be achieving anything. And I'm saying this just to go on record as saying that to me this is not a valid defence in the case of persons being investigated. Well, that's it. I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Yeah. I think you forgot one of your functions, is to supervise also the collection of the fines. You don't have that system in England. If a member of parliament absent himself without a reason that is accepted by the speaker, then he will be fined, or he will be, she will be fined. Yeah. And we collected quite a few thousands for, we introduced that about 2-3 years ago. Was it that, Clark, 2-3 years ago?
The speaker is suggesting maybe it's that in the national interest that members of parliament do not attend. That way, their contribution will be greater because there will be a financial contribution to the coffers of the
Thank you for the compliment.
Yeah. Anyhow, for your suggestion about, to share the experience of Commission of Public Standards between the Commonwealth, I can take it on board because I'm the chair of the small branches of the Commonwealth, and I meet also at the ESCO, and also we meet regularly at the Speakers' Conference, so that would be a good idea that we can do that. Well, I would like to thank you for both. Thank you very much for finding time to meet us and share your perspectives and experiences and with us, which certainly will help us when discussing procedural issues within our committee. I'm sure that all the members here of the committee will appreciate to think more about how we have to move forward. And I'm sure that there will be other opportunities for us to exchange also views in the future. I thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.